We would like to send out a special thanks to Sock Club for supporting The Trail Went Cold. And we would like to thank you, the listeners, by offering you the chance to earn 15% off your next order of socks when you visit sockclub.com/cold and use the discount code COLD. That's sockclub.com/cold and the discount code is COLD. Enjoy the show. Christmas Eve, 1973. New London, Connecticut. While changing a tire, 20-year-old Kevin Showalter is struck by a passing vehicle and killed in a hit-and-run. When police make no effort to solve the case, Kevin's mother is forced to fight for answers until a grand jury investigation is held years later, naming the town's former mayor as the probable driver of the vehicle. However, further complications ensue when another man comes forward to confess to the crime, creating much debate about who was actually responsible for Kevin Showalter's death. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our newest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and throughout the month of December, we have been covering some unsolved mysteries which took place around Christmas time. For this episode, I've selected a cold case which most of you are probably not familiar with, the unsolved hit-and-run death of Kevin Showalter, which took place on Christmas Eve in 1973. I first became familiar with this story when I included it in an article I published for listfirst.com 3 years ago about unsolved Christmastime mysteries, but at the time, I did not yet know how deep a rabbit hole it really was. Cold cases involving hit-and-run deaths are often very difficult to solve, because unless someone actually witnessed the event, there's usually very little evidence to work with. But the death of Kevin Showalter wound up ballooning into one of the most extensive hit-and-run cases in the history of the United States. The local police did such a terrible job that Kevin's mother had to become his sole advocate. The case eventually wound up in the hands of the state police, who would spend over $1 million on the investigation and garner national press coverage for this story. In spite of this, the case is not that well known today, though it still garners coverage in the local media, and there have been major developments as recently as 2005. We have one person who has been publicly named as the most likely perpetrator, but since there have been a number of unexpected twists and turns, a lot of ambiguity still surrounds what actually happened here. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold also has its own PayPal account and a donate button on the website. If there's anyone out there who wants to make a donation, we would greatly appreciate it, and we'll be sure to give you a shout-out on a future episode. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the unsolved death of Kevin Showalter. Our story begins in New London, Connecticut in 1973. Our central figure is 20-year-old Kevin Showalter, who is currently a student at Mitchell College. Kevin's parents are divorced, but he still remains close with his mother, Lucille Showalter, and his two brothers. On Christmas Eve, Kevin was working his job at a discotheque in Waterford. He became friendly with a young female patron named Deborah Emilita and invited her to attend a Christmas party with him. After Kevin's shift ended, he left his own car behind at the discotheque, so he and Deborah could drive to his apartment in her Ford Pinto. They spent the next few hours hanging out together, and decided they would not attend the Christmas party after all, so Kevin asked Deborah to drive him back to the discotheque so he could pick up his own car. On their way there, Deborah's Pinto suddenly sustained a flat tire on the residential street Pequot Avenue, which was located less than 2 blocks from where Kevin's mother lived. Deborah pulled over, and after discovering that the front driver's side tire was flat, Kevin pulled out a jack and crouched down beside the Pinto to change the tire. He recommended that Deborah switch off the vehicle's parking lights in order to conserve the battery, but tragedy would soon occur. At around 11:11 p.m., Kevin was attempting to change the tire when he was suddenly struck by a passing vehicle, which propelled his body 50 feet onto the sidewalk. The driver of the vehicle did not bother to stop and just kept on going. At the time, Deborah was sitting on top of a stone wall 6 feet away from the Pinto and remembered hearing a thud. While she was able to catch a glimpse of taillights driving away in the distance, she did not actually see the vehicle. In fact, even though numerous witnesses in the neighborhood would recall hearing noises from their homes and catching a glimpse of the taillights on the vehicle which struck Kevin, none of them got a clear enough look at it to provide a description. That night, Kevin's mother, Lucille Showalter, had been attending Christmas Eve services at her church before she returned home and went to bed. She would be woken up in the middle of the night by police officers, who told her that her son had been hurt in an accident. But when she arrived at the hospital during the early morning hours of Christmas morning, Lucille was horrified to learn that Kevin was now dead. The police informed Lucille that Kevin had been the victim of the hit and run, and she assumed that they would be investigating the crime and doing their best to find the driver who was responsible. However, Lucille started to sense that something was wrong when she showed up at the police station a few weeks later to retrieve Kevin's personal effects. To her astonishment, the police claimed that his personal effects had been lost, and flat out told Lucille that the case would probably never be solved. So this motivated Lucille to launch her own investigation. For starters, she got her hands on an FBI lab report which stated that dark green paint particles had been found on Kevin's clothing, which was consistent with the same shade of green which was often found on 1968 Chrysler vehicles. Lucille then did some exhaustive legwork, searching throughout the area for dark green vehicles which had any signs of damage on them. She asked local auto dealers and garages if they'd repaired any damaged vehicles shortly after Christmas Eve, and learned that most of them had not received any inquiries from the police. Lucille also interviewed a number of people, including witnesses from Kevin's accident scene, and came to the conclusion that the driver who hit him was likely from the area, given that Pequot Avenue was a residential street not known for getting much traffic. Lucille kept a written record of all her findings, and attempted to turn it over to the police, only for them to grow angry about her independent investigation and accuse her of withholding evidence. In spite of this, Lucille continued to actively campaign for answers, and even convinced the state into offering a $2,000 reward for information. One prominent citizen who did offer Lucille his full support was Harvey Malov, who had previously served 2 terms as mayor of New London and was now a wealthy, well-respected jewelry merchant. He told Lucille that he had actually driven past Kevin's accident scene at around 11:12 p.m. on Christmas Eve, only about a minute after Kevin had been struck. Malov remembered seeing a dark green car parked at an angle in front of the Pinto, and saw a middle-aged, clean-shaven man talking to a younger woman nearby. Malov claimed that he initially thought the guy might be a policeman, since city police were known for driving unmarked dark green vehicles. However, records showed that the earliest help arrived at the scene that night was 11:15. Anyway, the next few years would be an exercise in frustration for Lucille, as she constantly wrote numerous people in authority, such as the New London police chief, a local superior court judge, and the state's attorney, for a proper investigation into her son's death, but was often completely ignored. But Lucille's persistence eventually paid off when she wrote a letter to Connecticut Governor Ella T. Grosso. Only a few days before Christmas in 1976, a 1-man grand jury was created to investigate the case, and a superior court judge named Joseph Donaghy would be appointed. Thus began the start of a 1-year investigation which involved a re-examination of the evidence and re-interviewing witnesses. In total, the state police spent over $1 million, the largest amount of money ever spent on a hit-and-run investigation. The whole situation exposed just how badly the New London police had bungled the original investigation, as in addition to showing a lack of initiative to solve the case, they had also apparently lost some key pieces of evidence. The tow truck driver who arrived at the accident scene remembered finding green automobile body putty and turning it over to the police before it inexplicably disappeared. Some amber plastic, which may have been part of a signal light on the vehicle which struck Kevin, was also found at the scene, but subsequently went missing. The New London police also found some glass and did turn it over to the FBI for testing. The FBI determined that the glass likely belonged to a General Electric headlight before sending it back. However, when the state police wanted to analyze this glass years later, the New London police turned over a box containing what appeared to be glass fragments from multiple vehicles. An engineer from General Electric would determine that at least one of the glass fragments could not have been dislodged from a vehicle after hitting a pedestrian, and that it was likely removed from a headlamp socket by force. In other words, it did not belong to the car which struck Kevin. The state police also concluded that the dark green paint particles found on Kevin's clothing probably did not originate from this vehicle either. In total, the grand jury investigation involved 5 months of hearings with testimony from 107 witnesses. One of the most prominent witnesses was a police informant named Catherine Krause, who claimed that sometime in 1975, two women at a party told her about a father and son duo named Walter Spring Jr. and Walter Spring III, who had allegedly done repairs on the vehicle which struck Kevin. The Springs had operated an auto repair shop in New London in 1973 before moving to New Jersey. Krause came forward and shared this information with the state police in February of 1977, but claimed that once the Springs found out about it, they took her to Florida and held her in a motel room for a month in order to prevent her from talking. For months, the Springs were very uncooperative with the grand jury investigation and would not show up to testify until they received a court order. While Krause passed a lie detector test about her story, the Springs refused to take one, and a state trooper would testify that the Springs had allegedly threatened to, quote-unquote, rub out anyone who talked about the repair work on the hit-and-run car. After the grand jury proceedings concluded, and Judge Danahy looked at all the evidence, he finally issued a 37-page report in February of 1978. He concluded that, quote, "It is more probable than not that Harvey Malov was the operator of the offending vehicle," end quote. Danahy largely based this conclusion on the fact that Malov's story about driving past Kevin's accident scene right after it happened was contradicted by every other person at the scene. Malov claimed that he was driving a yellow 1970 Lincoln Continental that night, but seven witnesses, including Deborah Emilita, testified that they never saw a vehicle like that in the neighborhood. After Kevin was hit, one of the neighbors called the fire department, and Deborah claimed that there were no other vehicles at the scene until a fire rescue ambulance and the fire chief's car arrived at 11:15 p.m. In addition, every witness contradicted Malov's story about seeing a dark green car parked in front of Deborah's Ford Pinto. There was speculation that the so-called middle-aged man Malov saw speaking to a young woman might have actually been Kevin speaking to Deborah, and Malov just got confused about the time and had driven through the neighborhood before Kevin was hit. However, Malov specifically described seeing a clean-shaven man, and Kevin had a beard at that time. Malov's Lincoln Continental was examined by the state police in 1977, and there were signs of damage to the right fender area, along with some turquoise-green body putty. Malov could not recall how the vehicle sustained this damage, but given how much time had passed, there was no way to conclusively prove it had been caused by hitting Kevin. In 1974, the Chief State's Attorney's Office had inquired about whether the New London police inspected any of Malov's vehicles for damage. The police responded that they'd inspected six vehicles owned by Malov and found nothing, but the grand jury investigation discovered that this was a complete lie. There was also a tentative connection between Malov and the Spring family. Malov had been a member of the New London Redevelopment Corporation in 1973 and loaned the Springs $3,000 only 1 month before Kevin's death. So could Malov have called in a favor from them to repair the damage to his vehicle? All that being said, because police lost most of the evidence from the accident, there was nothing which could conclusively tie Malov to the scene, so Judge Danahy did not recommend criminal prosecution. Needless to say, Malov denied these allegations, and many of his supporters were not too happy with the fact that Danahy would publicly name him as the driver when there wasn't even enough evidence to file criminal charges. Maliv pointed out that he previously passed a lie detector test when questioned about the accident in 1975, and following the release of Judge Danahy's report, he immediately hired his own private investigator. Maliv hoped evidence would be uncovered to help clear his name, but the two of them had a falling out when the investigator did not deliver as promised. By this point, the case had already garnered a ton of national publicity, including an article in People magazine. The popular TV series, Lou Grant, even did an episode loosely based on this story about a young man who was killed in a hit-and-run accident by a prominent judge. It was essentially one of those Law and Order-style, ripped-from-the-headline stories inspired by real-life crimes, but Lucille Showalter said she did not like the episode, mainly because the mother character who was modeled after her was portrayed as a very rude and demanding person. Anyway, following the grand jury investigation, the reward for information leading to an arrest was raised to $20,000, but unfortunately, the 5-year statute of limitations on the crime of negligent homicide officially ended on Christmas Day in 1978. However, this would not be the end of this story. In September of 1979, Paul Hansen, a 29-year-old resident from the town of East Lyme, came forward and claimed that he was the driver of the hit-and-run vehicle which struck Kevin Showalter. Hansen claimed that after doing some heavy Christmas Eve drinking, he was driving home on Pequot Avenue when he recalled feeling an impact of some sort, though he did not notice hitting anyone. When Hansen woke up on Christmas morning, he had no memory of the previous night, but heard a news report about a young man being fatally struck by a vehicle on that street. After Hansen checked his car and noticed there was some damage, he grew horrified and became convinced that he was responsible for Kevin's death. Of course, by the time Hansen came forward, the statute of limitations had expired, so no criminal charges could be filed against him. However, it was still necessary to conduct a thorough investigation because Lucille had filed a $600,000 civil suit against the person who killed her son, but because no one had ever been charged with any crime, she had yet to fill in the name of the actual defendant. When questioned, Hansen wound up failing a polygraph test, and there would be another one-man grand jury headed by Judge Danahy. In August of 1981, Danahy ruled that there was no evidence to support Hansen's claims that he was responsible for Kevin's death. He also wrote, quote, "It will be difficult for some to agree with the end of this investigative inquiry. Psychologically, certain individuals cannot now, and probably never will, be able to accept that the case of Kevin B. Showalter will not be prosecuted at this time." End quote. And that pretty much brought an end to the investigation for a long time, and Lucille's civil suit was never filed. In 1989, Harvey Maliv died of cancer, but he never stopped attempting to clear his name. Sadly, Lucille Showalter would also succumb to cancer in May of 2000, and never wound up receiving justice for what happened to her son. But believe it or not, this would still not be the end of this story. In January of 2005, the case went back into the spotlight again after Paul Hansen committed suicide and left behind a letter in which he continued to claim responsibility for Kevin's death. This compelled police to reopen the case, and the local newspaper, The Day of New London, decided to conduct a new investigation. For years, Lucille Showalter had requested copies of the transcripts from the original grand jury proceedings, but was told they could not be released to the public. When The Day of New London attempted to request copies of the transcripts in 2005, they were denied by a Superior Court judge. But after pressing the issue further, guess what they found out? Even though it was 12 volumes, and over 3,000 pages long, it turned out the transcripts had mysteriously gone missing from the files in New London Superior Court without explanation, and incredibly, there also didn't seem to be any copies of these transcripts anywhere. So this pretty much brought all attempts at a new investigation to a dead halt. Even though this case garnered national exposure during the late 1970s, it has pretty much been forgotten about today. It only gets sporadic mention in the Connecticut media every now and then. Unfortunately, there are still no conclusive answers about who was actually responsible for the hit and run which killed Kevin Showalter. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our new sponsor, Sock Club, as we are very excited that they are now supporting The Trail Went Cold. The holidays are right around the corner, and Sock Club is delivering the perfect gift experience. This is a good time to remind your loved ones that you care each month with quality, American-made socks. The socks are sent straight to your door, featuring a different modern classic design each month that is perfect to add sophisticated fun to any wardrobe. Each package also contains a personalized gift message that can be customized each month. I am pleased to say that I am now teamed up with Sock Club, and they are offering us all 15% off. If you want to give a little reminder of your love every month, then give Sock Club. I just received a shipment of new socks from Sock Club, and it's a good thing too, because we have some pretty cold Canadian winters up here, and I desperately needed them. Before this, my drawer was filled with nothing but plain old boring worn-down black socks, but thanks to Sock Club, I'm going to spend my lead-up to Christmas wearing socks which are not only extremely warm and comfortable, but also very vibrant and colorful, and will help put me into the holiday spirit. So if you want to experience the same thing, take advantage of our special offer and go to sockclub.com/cold and get 15% off when you use the discount code COLD. That's sockclub.com/cold and you use the discount code COLD for 15% off. Thank you and enjoy the rest of our episode. This is definitely a very tragic story for everyone involved, and I don't think I've ever seen a hit-and-run case garner as much notoriety as this one. It has dragged on for decades now, but what's particularly sad about it is how preventable this whole situation could have been. When Judge Danahy released his report about the grand jury investigation, he actually stated that Kevin placed himself in a dangerous situation by changing the tire in a crouched position on a dark street and switching off the vehicle's parking lights. That's not to say Danahy was victim-blaming or anything, but he believed that the driver of the vehicle who hit Kevin genuinely did not see him, might not have realized they hit anyone when they drove off. Given the circumstances, Danahy did not think the driver was criminally negligent, and provided they weren't recklessly speeding or impaired at the time, they probably never would have faced any charges or jail time if they had just turned themselves in and confessed right after the accident took place. Of course, the driver might have been found if it weren't for the terrible work from the New London Police, and Judge Danahy's report was very critical of their investigation and the dismissive attitude they had towards Lucille Showalter. I mean, this wasn't a case where a young person's death was officially ruled a suicide or an accident, and their parent was screaming foul play because they had a hard time dealing with the tragedy. It's pretty clear-cut that Kevin was struck by a vehicle and the driver just took off. This is the same issue I addressed when I did my mini-sode on the Russell Evans case last year, where the evidence seemed to suggest that he was beaten to death, but the police were content to write off his death as a hit-and-run accident. Well, even if that was true, a hit-and-run is still a crime which ended someone's life, and whoever was responsible should be forced to answer for it. You can't just tell the victim's mother, well, this is probably never going to be solved, only a few weeks after the incident happened, and just leave it at that. Now, as critical as Judge Danahy was towards the New London Police, he did not actually believe they were orchestrating a deliberate cover-up, and thought their investigation was the result of incompetence rather than malice. But given that the prime suspect, Harvey Malev, was a former mayor who gave some high-ranking police officials their jobs, you might still be inclined to believe there was a conspiracy to sweep things under the rug if he was actually the driver of the car. And that's another issue. While the grand jury investigation did bring Lucille Showalter some semblance of peace, it did not provide full closure, and there was controversy over the fact that Judge Danahy publicly named Harvey Malev as the probable driver of the hit-and-run vehicle. This mostly stems from the fact that Danahy used the word probable rather than conclusive, as Maliv and his supporters argued that if the investigation could not conclusively prove that Maliv was the driver and he wasn't going to be prosecuted for the crime, then they should not have released his name to the public. If Maliv was innocent, then this caused a lot of unwarranted damage to his reputation. Maliv did bring up a valid point. A grand jury investigation is not the same thing as a trial, so he did not have the opportunity to present a case for his innocence, which would have occurred if he had actually been charged with the crime. It's kind of a catch-22, in that he spared the ordeal of a criminal trial, but short of finding hard evidence which points to another perpetrator, there really isn't anything he can do to clear his name. And when you take into account that another man, Paul Hansen, would later confess to the crime, then this is clearly not a cut-and-dried case. So let's compare these two suspects. A second grand jury investigation concluded that other than his own confession, there was no compelling evidence to suggest that Paul Hansen was responsible for the hit-and-run. And while there wasn't any hard evidence to link Harvey Maliv to the scene, he pretty much implicated himself by sharing a story about being there, which was contradicted by 7 eyewitnesses. But given that the New London police lost or badly mishandled most of the evidence they did have, it probably would have been impossible to conclusively link anyone to the accident scene. The big issue is that even though there's a lot of information out there about Harvey Maliv's background, there's virtually nothing about Paul Hansen. All we know about him is that he came forward, confessed to the hit and run, was cleared by a grand jury investigation, but then committed suicide and left behind a confession letter in 2005. Since he took his own life, we can reasonably assume that Hansen was a troubled individual, but other than that, there's nothing to go on. It's certainly possible that Hansen was driving drunk on Christmas Eve in 1973 and legitimately had no memory of anything that happened that night. When he heard about a fatal hit and run and noticed damage to his car the following day, he may have feared the worst, even though he did not remember anything. Of course, it's awfully convenient that Hansen wouldn't come forward until after the statute of limitations had expired, and if that's where his story had ended, then I'd have little doubt that he wasn't the driver. But the fact that Hansen would still take responsibility for the incident in a suicide note over 30 years later makes it impossible for me to discount him completely. Since I know nothing about what Hansen's personal life was like in 2005, I have no idea if the hit and run played any role in his decision to commit suicide. He might have just mentioned it in his note for attention, or he might have still been racked with guilt about the whole thing 3 decades later. One thing I am certain about is that if Hansen was the driver, then I don't think the New London police would have orchestrated a cover-up to protect him, since it doesn't sound like he was a person with connections, and he managed to stay completely off the radar for years. So if there was a cover-up, I'm sure the police would have been more inclined to orchestrate one for a wealthy, prominent citizen like Harvey Maliv. One of the most dramatic developments in this story is the testimony from Catherine Krause and her claims that Walter Spring Jr. and Walter Spring III held her against her will in a Florida motel room after she told the police they had done repairs on the vehicle which struck Kevin Showalter. I do admit to being a bit skeptical about this, though the Springs do sound like they might be shady people. I know that one investigator testified that he believed Krause and Walter Jr., who were both married at the time, had actually gone down to Florida together to carry on a secret affair, though I don't know if this was ever corroborated. It sounds like Walter Jr. had a habit of making himself out to be a big shot who once belonged to the mafia, and that the claims of him threatening to, quote-unquote, rub out anyone who talked about his repair work on the hit-and-run vehicle were greatly exaggerated. I know that when Harvey Maliv's Lincoln Continental was examined by the state police, they found traces of damage to the right fender in the approximate location where the hit-and-run vehicle might have struck Kevin. So if Maliv was responsible, then you might think this negates the story of the Springs doing secret repairs to his vehicle. Well, the problem is that we really only have Maliv's word that he drove the Lincoln Continental on Pequot Avenue that night, and since this damage was discovered over 3 years after the accident, it could have conceivably been caused by something else. I don't know. If that damage was caused by the hit and run, I really have my doubts that Maliv would have left it as is for years after the fact. So there are really 3 possibilities here. A. The whole story about the Springs is fabricated, and they have no involvement with the hit and run. B. The Springs repaired Maliv's Continental, and he sustained damage from something else afterward, or C, the Springs did secret repairs to the vehicle which struck Kevin, but someone else besides Harvey Malov was the driver. For his part, even though Malov's Redevelopment Corporation had loaned $3,000 to the Springs prior to the accident, he testified that he had never met them before, as he did not personally oversee every loan his corporation made. The one thing which really seems to implicate Malov is his story about passing through the accident scene that night. It was contradicted by everyone who was there, and without that story, I don't think Judge Danahy would have had much grounds to name Malov as the probable hit-and-run driver. But I'm still trying to wrap my head around why Malov would have shared that story in the first place. If he was guilty, my best guess is that he was paranoid that one of the witnesses might have seen his vehicle driving down Pequot Avenue, so he had to concoct a cover story to explain what he was doing there at that time. However, since none of the witnesses got a good enough look at the hit-and-run vehicle to provide a description, Malov's fabricated cover story was unnecessary, and wound up backfiring on him instead. The weird part is that Malov would share a story about seeing a dark green car parked at the scene, as that was easily refuted by everyone else who was there. This might have stemmed from the fact that there were dark green paint particles found on Kevin's clothing, and the initial FBI lab report stated that it matched the type of paint often found on a 1968 Chrysler, a car which Malov would not have owned at that time. So this might have been Malov's subtle way of pointing the investigation towards an alternate vehicle, though the state police would later conclude that the green paint particles were likely a red herring and did not originate from the car which hit Kevin. You might be wondering why Malov would have decided to share such a blatantly false story with Lucille Showalter, but if he was the driver, he might have felt guilty over what happened and the fact that she was being treated so badly by the police. So Malov decided to play the role of the supportive friend and toss Lucille a bone by telling her about this fictitious green car in order to give Lucille something to chase after. Maybe he thought this was the best thing he could do for Lucille, aside from confessing to the crime and turning himself in. Of course, Malov's ulterior motive might have been to lead the trail away from him, and he probably never envisioned that Lucille would eventually get far enough for a grand jury investigation to be launched. I know that Judge Danahy ruled that the investigation into Kevin's death was hampered by incompetence rather than a deliberate attempt at a cover-up, but I actually think there are a number of things which point to the latter scenario. I mentioned earlier that there was suspicion that the green paint particles on Kevin's clothing were planted there and did not belong to the vehicle which struck him. There's also the box containing the headlight glass fragments which was turned over to the state police for the grand jury investigation. It contained at least one fragment which did not originate from the hit and run, and was likely deliberately removed from the headlight socket of a totally different vehicle. It seems the glass fragment was deliberately planted there by someone who hoped no one would notice the difference, but an engineer from General Electric did. I will concede that this might have been done by the New London police to cover up the fact that they lost some of the original headlight glass recovered from the accident scene, rather than because they were attempting to protect someone. But it still looks pretty bad regardless. Prior to the grand jury, it also looks like there were several deliberate attempts to prevent Harvey Malov from being investigated. For instance, after ignoring Lucille Showalter on multiple occasions, the county administrative judge, Angelo Santinello, promised her that he would hold a coroner's inquest, but they never actually issued a finding. Well, it turned out that Judge Santinello was Malov's best friend. No transcript was ever provided for this coroner's inquest until years after the fact, and Santinella always claimed that he had put his niece in charge of typing up the transcript, but she never got around to it. And speaking of transcripts, how about the fact that the transcripts from the original grand jury investigation mysteriously went missing in 2005 when the Day of New London attempted to obtain them? Now, these transcripts have been withheld from the public since 1978, so there's no way to pinpoint the exact time period they went missing. But they were 12 volumes, and over 3,000 pages long. You don't just lose something like that by accident. It takes work to get rid of that much material. So this indicates to me that someone took steps to make the transcripts disappear, possibly because there was something incriminating in there which they did not want to be released publicly, particularly if Lucille could have used it as evidence to win a civil suit. And this is what makes me think that Paul Hansen wasn't the actual driver of the car. His name was never mentioned during the grand jury proceedings, and no one even knew who he was until a year after the fact, so there would be no need to get rid of the transcripts or destroy evidence in order to protect him. But the big question is, was there something in those transcripts to incriminate Harvey Maliff, or someone else entirely? Well, there's no way I can say this with 100% certainty, but I think there's a pretty compelling circumstantial case to make Maliff the strongest suspect. Mainly that he told an obviously false story, placing himself at the accident scene, and I see no reason for him to do this if he wasn't involved. This obviously isn't strong enough evidence to ever build a criminal case against him, but it's enough to rile up suspicion. From all I've read about Maliff, he seemed to be a very well-liked and respected citizen, and I can give him the benefit of the doubt that he honestly did not see Kevin when he struck him, and may have been completely unaware that he hit anyone when he left the scene. If Maliff wasn't intoxicated or driving recklessly at the time, then this is probably one of those unavoidable tragic accidents in which no one is completely at fault. If Maliff had just come clean right at the outset, he probably wouldn't have faced criminal charges and saved everyone a lot of pain. And from what I've read about Lucille Showalter, I think she probably would have forgiven him. But Maliff probably felt he had a reputation to maintain and could not connect his name to an incident which caused the death of another person. However, maybe I'm 100% wrong on this, and Maliff is completely innocent, and the real driver is another suspect we don't know about. Whoever it was, I think it had to be someone prominent enough that people would be willing to sandbag an investigation and destroy evidence in order to protect them. Maybe probable was too strong a word for Judge Danahy to use to name Harvey Maliff, but he does seem more likely than anyone else to be the perpetrator. Now, since Lucille Showalter and the two prime suspects, Harvey Maliff and Paul Hansen, have passed away, it's unlikely we'll ever learn the full truth about what happened. And even if we did, it's not like the perpetrator could be charged, since the statute of limitations has long expired. However, Kevin had two brothers, and as far as I know, they're both still alive today. Kevin's younger brother, Chuck, actually published an editorial about the case in the Day of New London on Christmas Eve in 2008. It was a classy piece of writing in which he expressed his condolences to the families of Harvey Maliff and Paul Hansen for all the suffering they had to endure. But it's also clear the Showalter family has gone through a lot of pain these past four decades, and it would be nice if they could receive closure and finally put this matter to rest. So if you happen to have any information about the hit-and-run death of Kevin Showalter, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Just wanted to give another shout out to all my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit and the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum. We also received a new donation this week from a listener named Heather, so thank you very much, Heather. Need to provide my thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. We also have a Facebook discussion group, so if you feel like discussing the podcast or the cases we feature with myself and your fellow listeners, feel free to join, and I'll approve your entry into the group ASAP. And just one more reminder that if you're looking to purchase some new socks for the winter, please check out our sponsor, Sock Club, and receive a 15% discount if you visit the website sockclub.com/cold and use the promo code COLD. If you use their product, you'll never again have to utter those horrifying words, "The feet went cold." And like I mentioned earlier, we also have a donate button on our website. So if you're feeling generous and want to express your appreciation for all the hard work we put into this podcast, we'd be extremely grateful. So next week is going to be our final holiday-themed episode before Christmas, and for a nice change of pace, we're going to be presenting an upbeat mystery for once in order to put you in the holiday spirit. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for our final Christmas-themed episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.